Welcome to The Edges of Lean. I'm Bella Engelbach, and in this podcast, we explore the human and creative side of lean thinking, unusual places where lean thinking is practiced. We meet people who are practicing continuous improvement in many different flavors and styles. So come along with me on a journey to the edges of lean. Episode 77, The Continuous Improvement Conversion Experience with Tom Hughes. Tom Hughes was an expert in lean and continuous improvement. He knew it all and frankly found it somewhat boring. But one day his opinion completely changed and he became a self-described overnight lean maniac. Now you would be hard-pressed to find someone more excited than Tom, who has now written a book called Improvement Starts With I, a practical guide to building an extraordinary lean culture. So what happened? He's here to tell us. Tom Hughes, welcome to The Edges of Lean.
Thanks for having me, Bella. Much appreciated.
Well, I really am enjoying having you here. I love my Irish lean folks. There's so much great lean happening in Ireland, and I'm really looking forward to you telling us more about that. Yeah. But let's get started by you telling us about Tom and about what you do today and what was your path to doing what you do today?
Yeah, it's an interesting path. I grew up not far from where I'm sitting here. I'm in Northern Ireland at the moment. I left the country boy background and went to study in England. I went to university in Birmingham, which is the heart of the UK automotive industry. I studied engineering. I was very fortunate to get a job in automotive. I was the lowest of the low. I shouldn't say that, but figuratively on the organization chart, I had the very good fortune to have 6 months on the production line before I even knew I would get anything higher up. And I was in quality and supplier development for about 10 years and mostly in first tier automotive supplying the Japanese. Worked in Germany for a while. I came back to Ireland to do an MBA. Don't shoot me. I studied at Trinity College Dublin, which was a privilege, a very famous institution. From there, I went and I went into general industry. I was a supply chain director for a private equity backed company called O'Lair. And we carried out a management buyout of O'Lair about 2 years in. And we grew that business to 200 million euro, dollars, I should say.
Yeah.
And we did the fairy tale exit to Parker Hannifin. And during that whole time, I would have been like in the automotive, it would have been very much practitioner, frontline level lean. We wouldn't even call it lean back then in the early 90s over here. But even the O'Lair period, that 10 years, I would have been applying the principles and even some of the cultural aspects of lean subconsciously, like the respect for people and a very egalitarian approach to management. But I perceived lean as a bunch of tools and techniques. And so that all changed about 3 or 4 years ago. I was doing a turnaround here in Northern Ireland and it was a metal bashing company. I thought I was coming in to do a strategic repositioning of the organization. But day one, the owners came to my desk and asked me the immortal words of, "We want you to implement lean." And honestly, I was horrified.
You were horrified.
I was really horrified because my experience of lean had been, it's really effective, very efficient, great for driving productivity. But my perception was that it was just a bunch of tools and techniques. It was a thing that you needed consultants to do. You needed staff and you needed people dedicated to it. And in this environment in particular, it was a 60 people company. We didn't have the resource as I saw I needed it to implement lean. So it was like, well, am I going to do it? And further from that, I had been in charge of a couple of $100 million company. Well, I was number two in that organization. And I was like, I'm way above this. That's honestly what I thought.
Oh, I'm too good to do this. Is that what you thought?
I'm too good for this. I'm a business leader. I'm strategic. So thankfully, for all concerned, I did a couple of weeks, believe it or not, in that organization doing things like 5S workshops and training the different production cells. But wow, was it hard work. And I got our local government agency to come in. And the only reason I asked them in is because I thought we could get some money out of them in order to fund some staff. That wasn't a thing. But this is where it gets interesting, folks. They showed me this video of Paul Akers touring Seating Matters, which are a local Northern Ireland firm here. And in my opinion, the best SME-sized lean organization on the planet. And that's still my opinion today. Mm-hmm. And I watched this video and it just blew me away within seconds. And it was, what got me was the energy. It was just everybody in the video was lit up and full of inspiration and enthusiasm and excitement. And I was like, wow, I want that. Now that lean, that's my kind of lean. So because the whole organization change thing and driving a really engaged culture was something that we particularly achieved at O'Lair. We had an exceptionally engaged team and really cohesive, like 600 people in 16 different geographies working together pretty seamlessly. Like the people from Parker couldn't believe what we could do in terms of, you know, things like managing large international accounts. So for example, say Bosch Rexroth were one example. We would have dealt with them in 16 different countries, yet we were able to coordinate that account from behind the scenes in a seamless way that the customer thought and looked at us as one single organization. That's hard to do.
Tom, you had been part of, driven that transformation at Parker, right?
Well, we were O'Lair that were then bought.
O'Lair, right. So yeah. You had been part of that, but it didn't, this whole idea of lean being more than a bunch of tools still hadn't clicked for you, right?
No, definitely not. And so the whole experience of O'Lair was about building that cohesive team of people that had a very, very high degree of alignment and teamwork and minimal organizational friction. But we'd built that the hard way. So yeah. We did it ad hoc. We didn't have a system or a process to do that. We'd managed to do it through very skillful management. That's the honest truth. But we had no process for it. So that was the second thing I saw here with the Paul Akers Seating Matters thing was, right, well, my previous impression of lean was that it was a thing that you needed team and staff and lots of resource mm-hmm. and time and money. And I got this, and a relatively elite group of people were doing it. You know that? The whole Six Sigma almost approach of black belts.
Right, right. And you want your people are going to be trained and maybe you're not doing belts, but it's going to be kind of like belts. Yeah.
So what I loved about this approach was, one, it was going to be about everybody doing lean. So I didn't need a team. Yeah. I was enough. I knew I could lift 60 people doing this and we were all going to do this lean thing. So that was the leadership challenge that I knew I was up for and I knew I could manage. And the second thing was the process of the morning meeting every day and we in the 2 second lean world, we have 3 S's instead of 5. And this sweep, sort, standardize and improvement time every day. I could really see how that would work before I even started. So that was my big epiphany, and that's what got me excited. And my next problem was I'm the only one and I didn't own the company. How am I going to persuade all these other people to do this, especially the ownership team? So I have this in the book. I didn't mention the book yet, but I wrote a book called Improvement Starts With I as a result of my my 20 years previous organization change experience, but particularly describing a process of how you do this as approach to lean. And the title is Improvement Starts With I. That all comes from my very first voicemail that I exchanged with Paul Akers, because I engaged with Brian Tierney. He advised me to read 2 Second Lean. I'd read 2 Second Lean within 48 hours. I got it more or less straight away. Ryan said to me, just reach out to Paul Akers. And I was like, what?
He'll never talk to me, right?
Yeah, some random dude from Nowheresville, Northern Ireland. And this guy sold like X 100,000 books. Anyway, I write him this big wall of text on WhatsApp. You know, hey, how do I persuade the ownership team to do this? Blah, blah, right? And I've got a QR code linking a recording of the voice, the very first voice recording in the book. It's classic. So his reaction is, hey, what a great message, but who are you? So he then went on to say, all you got to do, don't worry about trying to persuade people. All you got to do is worry about yourself. You focus on yourself and your own waste, and you get world-class at eliminating that. You have enough waste for 14 lifetimes. You just focus on that. And when you do that, you'll become a magnet and the rest will follow.
And so when you heard that, what was your reaction, Tom? Did you say, oh no, I wanted the next tool?
No, awesome. No. My reaction was awesome. So, because here's the thing, right? Everybody gets stressed out when they're trying to control other people.
Right. Yeah.
So this takes the stress out of it. I control me. I have a span of control around me. So what I did was, I described this all in the book. I became an overnight lean maniac. That is no joke. An overnight lean maniac. So I started right away. I was improving everything around me. I was making cheesy little videos about my improvements. And the early ones are in the book. Like how I make my morning smoothie and transform it from 20 minutes to 3 and that kind of thing. And I just started having fun with it, genuinely. And I started doing things like talking about 8 wastes. And I was like, what is he on about? I started using language like improvement opportunities instead of problems. And in my own stand-up meetings. And then I started telling the management team about this 2 Second Lean thing, and I did think it was great. And I was recommending to them to read the book. And I persuaded that part, I did. I persuaded and pulled them to read the book. I started to organize local lean tours here in Northern Ireland of companies that were doing this 2 Second Lean thing. So I was pulling these guys out, the other owners, out to these other organizations. And I learned a lot even with that. Because I was taking them initially to a really small company. That was the first one I could get access to. They're only 6 people and they don't do what we do.
Yeah.
Right? So they couldn't connect. And then I got them to another company, Cocoon Rugs, here in Northern Ireland. They're world class. They're basically Amazon for rugs for UK, Ireland, and a lot of Europe. But again, we go there. And there's 60 people and they're like huge energy. But they don't make anything. They only distribute.
So they're not the same as us,
that's
right?
Not us. Like, yeah. We have an expression here in the UK, the NIMBY, not in my backyard.
My backyard, yeah.
Yeah, so it's like, that's not my backyard. So it was only when I got them to Seating Matters, because they did all kinds of horrible manufacturing, like cutting wood. You know, if anybody's been in a traditional wood shop, and I did when I was a kid, sawdust everywhere, yeah. They cut wood, they welded, they cut metal, they had laser cutting, and they'd all painting. And, oh, well, can't say no anymore. And when you go and see there's lots of YouTube Seating Matters stuff. Ryan Tierney's got a great YouTube channel. I highly recommend it. So we got there and that, okay, right, okay, we can do this. But that was a period of already of about 2 to 3 months from my epiphany. Meanwhile, and again, I described this in the book, we had some major challenges that we had to change before we could even start doing real, like that whole morning meeting and improvement time process. We had a piece rate system that was like probably 40 years old, that would basically, if you didn't make your rate, you were on minimum wage. So it didn't, basically people didn't want to train anybody else because that would mean they'd lose efficiency and lose money and therefore didn't want to do it. People almost owned machines that they could make rate on.
This is mine. Don't touch it.
Yeah, don't touch my machine. Only I know this. So it didn't exactly like cross training and stuff was not a good thing. Stopping to make any kind of improvement. Forget it.
You'd lose money, right?
I had to do that whole persuasion thing as well. The organization had previously relied on that to manage the people. So we had to get rid of all of that. And again, I describe a new payment structure in the book that we invented for that specific environment. And it was around hands, heart, and head. And we eliminated all short-term productivity incentives. So basically hourly rates. And you improved the more you engaged with Lean and the more you progressed through cross-functional training. And the more you could show that you were taking personal control for your own development. So we had to sell that to 60 people. And part of our process, and this is, again, happy accidents. We made that change before we started the morning meeting process. And we had to meet every single individual to make that payment change. Mm. So, you know, what a signal to the organization that these guys are serious. So we're going to change how we pay you. We had to sit down with everybody, normally like a 10 or 15 minute chat. And that kind of comes back to an earlier thing I said. What I really now understand that real cultural lean is about building connection. And that's what we were already doing. We were already building connection in a totally new way.
So that was, as you say, it was a happy accident, but yeah. I think it's also a really important thing to look at. So, Tom, I read all the books, talk to all the people. Very few people talk about things like pay structure as impeding change, right? And it's something that's been for me a frustration. You know, when you start out teaching lean and you play some of these games where at the end of the game everybody's changed their role, nobody wants to have a discussion about, well, if you changed all the roles, how are you now going to pay people? And there's usually nobody from finance or from HR, you know, in there, you know, to have that discussion. Never mind the union, right? So but that, how fundamental is that? That is people, how people get paid is going to drive, it's a big part of how they drive, what drives their behavior and their productivity.
Definitely. And it goes beyond even the key performance indicators in my experience. Yeah. Like, way before this is why the book isn't just 3 or 4 years thing. The book's really 30 years of experience, because right back in my very first automotive job, production and quality were constantly fighting like dogs.
Yeah.
Seriously. And I'm thinking a lot of manufacturing organizations, that's still the case, because production people are primarily driven by getting bits out the door.
Yeah,
and
right.
Quality people regardless of how we want to paint it, when there's a customer concern comes through, the quality guys own it, and they own resolving it and providing the countermeasure and doing the root cause analysis and all of that. And the front end pain from the customer generally is some guy from the quality department. So until you address payments even higher in terms of that hierarchy, I recommend this in the book. I have a first chapter after the intro of my epiphany. I use the term to cover the chapter, candor. And I use one term about change the people, because it's about building alignment in that management team. If you don't have alignment, you'll fail. And in my opinion, the ownership from the top person, and I mean ownership, not like support, ownership from the top person and the alignment of that senior team is often and most the fundamental reason lean fails.
Yeah.
So I describe that, and I use the term change the people. And I'm very candid about it. If you've, as a leader myself, haven't done like without exaggerating, at least half a dozen turnarounds. You know when you decide to move from A to B, who's going to be good and who's not. Yeah, and honestly, you know it right away, frankly. It's compassionate to allow people the space to come on board, and you might be happily surprised. But honestly, I'm very candid in the book. That's rare. Rare that people turn around. And what I've seen countless times, especially in smaller organizations, especially if they're family owned, there's one or two family members that just don't get this. And you can do all the morning meetings and all you want, but if that afternoon somebody just decides to go down to the shouting and blaming and the disrespect for people, it tears everything else apart. So
Because everybody knows that that morning meeting where everybody was nice and kind and listening to each other was fake.
It's fake. It's hypocrisy, which thanks, Bella, because you brought up my favorite management topic.
Again, hypocrisy or fakeness?
Hypocrisy. That's why part of the reason I didn't do this overtly when I wrote the book, but I now know that it was in there back of here somewhere. Improvement starts with I is because most managers are hypocrites. That's the truth. They want people to do what they're not doing. So I'll give you an explicit example that I've had countless times. Why is housekeeping bad? Why aren't they making improvements? They don't care about X. And it always has they in there, right? Them over there, those people. And whenever you are, well, hang on, are you doing it? Oh, me? Oh, how are you demonstrating that you're doing it? Oh, I didn't really think about it like that. And that's so common. So even when we go to Lean, there'll be a huge amount of Lean people, and I'm sure there are contingent improvement facilitators and everybody listening to this. It's like, does the top person practice Lean, or does he talk about it?
Right.
Does he provide support? Does he give budgets to it? But is he improving what he does every day? I'll tell you, the answer to that is rare. There's not many of them around. And whenever people get that nugget, that's what this is about. If you're going to, here's something, right? I'm sure we got Lean consultants on the call, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. There's two forms of Lean consultancy now, because I'm helping people do this. I'm not a coach consultant myself. I'm a core business, and I have this Gamma Docs thing that we sell and so on. I am helping and mentoring people for free every day, and I love it. I love the service, and I grow so much. Consultants are brought in to improve processes, and consultants are great at it. And that's traditionally what Lean consultants are doing, in my opinion. But what I'm talking about is culture change.
Right.
You can't buy that. There is no buy. You can buy transition resource to help you if you're a large organization, get from A to B, but you can't get away from doing the heavy lifting yourself. And that's the part that people don't like, because the first thing, you can buy that. You can buy improvement process. You can be, I'll throw names that I don't know anybody. So for not hurting the innocent, any big listed company that's multi-billion dollar, you can buy a bunch of people in and move your process 20% more efficient and spend a few hundred thousand dollars. Yeah, that's any manager can do that, I guess. But do you want a Lean culture? That's a whole other ballgame.
And that's such a question, Tom, because it's not just do you want a Lean culture, but do you know what it is when you say you want a Lean culture, what that really means?
Yeah.
Right? So you could say, I want a Lean culture. But if that means, and I've actually had a leader say this to me, if that means I have to change my behavior, I'm going to learn something new. I don't really want that. I want you all to do it. Yeah,
and that's, again, improvement starts with I. It keeps coming back to that. And the thing is, it doesn't mean you're a bad person that you don't want to do this.
Yeah, right.
But if you want a Lean culture and you don't want to do it, those things don't match. Go and find another way to run your business. That's my advice. So I love that whole candor chapter. which looks at the change of people in alignment and do you want to do it, and the KPIs and the payment structure. That whole thing is the most fundamental thing. Once you get that right, because once you've got that aligned team that want to do it, and all the rest of it is relatively academic, it's tactics. And here's the thing that I've now come to understand at a better level. In the book, I talk about engagement improvement results in that order. And that, again, lean fails because short-sighted managers look for results too early and go, right, this isn't working. That's a problem, because if you haven't got engagement, and you're not going to get improvement results. But I've actually, in my second edition, which I'm going to release in hopefully 6 months, I've now refined that. I've added a couple of things, which isn't lean, but we needed to. It's now engagement, education, and recognition. That's what culture building is about. Then you get improvements, then you get results. So think about it. If people aren't interested, which is what I really mean about engagement, they're not curious and interested in wanting it, you're really not going to have a good time, because you're just trying to do school again, aren't you? And like, so you can turn up to school and cram for your exam, but did you internalize anything?
No. You don't really change.
You know, like my daughter's just finished a bunch of exams, and she was honestly, last night she was saying, you know, that stuff I studied for my exam, I can't remember any of it. And that's the sitting down for the 3-day course that you didn't want to turn up to, right? So you need that, build that curiosity and pull, and then you need to educate people so they see their waste and they know how to improve. If they don't see the waste or know how to improve, how are you ever going to get improvements? And then finally, the recognition is like the fuel and the fire that keeps everything going. And the recognition is both positive and negative. Obviously, you want the emphasis to be positive, but you also want to have the, I walked in today, guys, and the bin was overflowing. That isn't us. That needs to be in that meeting too, to keep that, to make it clear what we expect. So you're reinforcing and recognizing. It's almost a double R. But from there, how you achieve that, like I'm helping these days traditional manufacturing companies. I'm helping people who are agriculture people. I'm helping people that are in service-based businesses, helping people with fleets of vans of engineers out in the road so that their head office only has a small amount of their people. How do we do lean? It's easier by far when you recognize that those are the three things you need to do. You don't need to, what people have done with 2-second lean, and I've been very candid about this as well, they tried to paint it by numbers. I have to do the way Paul Akers did it.
Right.
And that's not true. You don't have to. It's, in fact, it's a big reason for failure. You need to look at what the fundamental principles are that you have to achieve. The rest is your skillful management of the tactics to employ it in your organization. So, you know, for example, I get asked questions like, I'm in a food processing business and we have to run 24 hours and we can't stop. And how are we going to do this 3S and how are we going to do the morning meeting? And look, what happens if we're in a continuous process business and we can't stop for a morning meeting, etc.? It's simple. All you got to do is worry about, how do you get engagement and education and recognition? How you do your morning meeting? Let the machines run. Decide that you're going to have a small cadre of people that are going to rotate and keep the machines running while the majority of us are in the morning meeting, etc. So,
but it's about that engagement first, right?
Yeah.
Tom, because you could come up with that countermeasure and people will still find another reason why it's not going to work if they're not interested, if it doesn't have any pull for
relevance.
Them.
You know, the best way to get people engaged, this might shock you.
What's that?
Tell them that you don't want them to work hard. And mean it.
Yeah.
And mean it. Like, that first place where I did 2-second lean, like, you're going from that piece rate culture, you're not going to get paid. And it's like really, really hard driven. And early doors in that experience, I stood up in front of 60 people and told them, I actively don't want you to work hard. Actively. I really don't want to see you struggle.
That is a very countercultural message, because we hear this all the time, you know, work hard, play hard. Well, if you work hard all day, you're going to be too tired to play hard at night, right? Or, you know, or whatever.
Totally, your quality problems, everything comes from struggle. So the beautiful thing, I went to Japan and had a lean study mission with Paul Akers. It's a great story. This is in the book as well. So he is a force of nature, that man. He's insane. I regard him as my dad. I would talk to Paul pretty much every day. I love the man to pieces. So you go to the whole experience was immense. Japan's obviously awe-inspiring, and I'd never been to Japan in spite of all the automotive stuff. But the thing that impressed me most was watching him improve every day. He was making dozens of improvements in front of you every day. And I'm there going, wow, look at him. I'm going to make 5 improvements a day right now, right? This is like day 1 or 2. The last day, not one improvement.
Not one. And so not what happened?
Not one from me. No, not one. And so we had this lunch before we went to Lexus. And I've got this on video, and it's in the book again. So I'm like, I'm coming out with my abject failure to Paul. Look, I wanted to make improvements. I didn't make any. How do you see? How do you make all these improvements? How do you do it? And you've probably heard something like this before, but this time I had the penny fully drop. It clicked. Paul went, it's easy. It's all I do is look for struggle. If I'm very sensitive to struggle. And when I see things bottleneck and bunch up, I just see there's an opportunity to improve. A kindergarten person could do it. And for me, honestly, that little trip flicked in my head. And I haven't gone a week without 20 improvements since then. And that's over 2 years ago. I document them all. So it is as simple as that. And then I was able to go back to our people from that trip and say, look, all we got to do is look for struggle. And it embellished my previous message of I don't want you to work hard, because the improvements are in the struggle. That's the easiest way to see it. And that's the easiest way to get people engaged. But you have to actually mean it. And again, when you're doing this lean process in this manner, you're going to have a dip in productivity. We were taking an hour out of our day from banging widgets initially. You don't have to do that. I actually wouldn't recommend you do. But you're going to take half an hour at least. And you're going to lose some productive time. But we made 26% productivity improvement within 5 months. Measurable, like from the old piece rate system. And that was with taking an hour out of your day. And
that was a very good investment, but it was scary, right, at the time. For some people, it must have been terrifying.
You know what, Bella? It honestly wasn't. Because I had the good fortune, my production manager when I was in France, who went on to be the same level as me in Olaire, I was talking to him about 2-second lean when I first, and I was scared. I was like, how am I going to get this hour thing? And Nick said to me, all you got to do is get 15% better. How long is it going to take you to get 15% better in an 8-hour shift? And I was thinking, because I knew we had huge mountains of waste. And honestly, after that, I was like, probably about 6 weeks. And I know that might sound crazy, but that's honestly, and I wasn't far wrong. We were leveling out from the initial dip in the second month.
And then... And then coming back up and going on from there.
But here's the other thing. Like, I want to get this across to people. The joy that you get when you approach lean like this is insane. It's like you're watching people blossom in front of your eyes. And that's the best thing about this approach. It's just why I got lit up in the first place. It's all I ever enjoyed doing in my career was developing people, watching them grow. And I'm controversial. Like, if they left our organization because they had better opportunities elsewhere, great.
Good for them, proud
that I was able to help somebody grow and move on. But this approach, when you're applying it, it's not all sunshine and rainbows. I go over that in graphic detail in the book again. But when you get it right, you never want to work in a different way. And the numbers look great. Everybody who does it well ends up being a leader in their sector and so on and so forth. So it's a great way to be.
So Tom, I don't want to go all the way back to when you sat down with people and you're having those 15-minute conversations about how you were going to change how they were paid. And you must have heard some interesting things in those conversations. How illuminating were those conversations above and beyond the pay piece?
You know what, Bella? Honestly, I didn't learn that much because I've done so much homework talking to lots of individuals.
You were already prepared,
Here's the thing. I learned this in France. You don't have a meeting that you don't know what the outcome's going to be. Not in public. So in France, meetings are like ceremonies.
Decisions have already been made. Yes, I've experienced that. Yes.
And then back to the Birmingham analogy of blood and snot on the wall. That's all done outside the meeting.
Yeah.
You don't do it in the meeting. So I already had that. So I talked to so many people. And already had, because I had the other owners sitting beside me in those meetings, and I didn't want them to be messy. So I'd already done all the work. And again, when anybody's doing an organization change, this is so cool. So say you take a typical 60 people. In that whole organization, genuinely, there's no more than 7 or 8 people that really matter when you want to make a change. That's the truth. There are opinion formers. They're key influencers. They can be people that are in the bottom end of the organization chart that dictate the general feeling of the rest of them. That is a fact. I've been through this many times in my career. So you got to spot who those people are and get them on board. And then the rest of them will follow.
Everyone else will follow.
So the thing with those meetings, we did another crucial thing. We changed job titles. And we told them why as well. So we used to have the term supervisor. I struggle not to swear now. I hate that term. Supervisor implies that we need somebody that has to look over you because we don't trust you.
You need to be supervised.
It's a horrible word. So we changed it to team leader. And we also had candid discussions with the team leaders about that's what we wanted to happen. We want team leaders. We don't want supervisors. And we want team members, not operators and low-down people. So that was our 2 job titles. When we changed the payment, we did that as well. And we told them why. So that's the behavior we're after. And then the great thing with the payment change as well, we were telling them what we wanted explicitly. This is another brilliant one that my experience in manufacturing is not just in Ireland or the UK. The amount of times somebody goes, my dog's ill. It's a big vet bill. Can I have more money? That was a weekly occurrence in this company. Just a variation of the theme. I need more money because
my life.
I deserve more. I think I deserve more, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Literally weekly. And reason why people would leave and all kinds of that. But with that clarity, we put it on like, it was probably 15 feet wide and 6 feet high on the canteen wall with numbers on it, telling people, if you do this, you get that. Very explicit, no exceptions. And so then it eliminated all that. And we still had it the odd time. Somebody go, I need X. Well, if you looked at the canteen wall, Well, are you doing what you need to do that it says on the canteen wall? No, not yet. Well, look, and again, I want to give you the money and mean it again. Because
you're being authentic with that.
Because if we have a bunch of people that like every single machine in the factory has 10 people that knows how to run it and set it up and make efficiency improvements on it, and we have a bunch of like fully engaged lean maniacs who are making improvements and posting them out every day, and we have et cetera, et cetera, we'll have the best company on the planet. So it won't matter if we have to give you 40% more than the market rate. We're happy. Do you get me? So that's the way of, it's a point you hit on yourself about the pay. But I am a big believer in intrinsic motivation first. So you have to have people just wanting to do a good job. You can't pay people into being
engaged. Right, because then they're going to go through the motions and...
Totally, right. But it can be a huge barrier. It won't fix it, but it really can be a big part of what's stopping it happening. So,
and if people are in an economic circumstance where they're focused on, I don't know how I'm going to get through the week, then they're not putting their full attention on making improvements at work or doing the work while they're at work. So you don't want people to be feeling my focus is elsewhere because I'm just struggling to get through the week or get to the payday, right?
And that's so terrible. Like, it's not worse than now. The whole planet is having a problem, especially at the lower socioeconomic groups with everything that's going on, inflation and everything. It's very, very, very tough. And my heart genuinely bleeds for that. But the beautiful thing here, when you take this approach again, you could say to somebody, look, mate, if you do a year hard graft, you could be on that top level. And if most people would have had the innate capability, if they wanted to put the effort in, they could move their salary up roughly 30%. And that potential is in this organization. Whereas if you go to look elsewhere, and again, everybody has this churn turnover, you guys call it in the US. But if you're in an organization where you know you have the potential to earn 30% more if you put the effort in, well, it's a lot less attractive to go somewhere else where it's highly unlikely that you're going to get a big bump to start with. And you don't know what's going to happen after that.
So right. Yeah.
It's. I didn't really intend our discussion to be about pay, but it's crucial.
It's so crucial fundamental, thing. Right? It's so fundamental. And it's one of those things, Tom, I think, going back to how we get trained on lean, we talk about process or we talk about respect for people, whatever we think that means. But we don't talk about these things that actually create the environment that people are working inside. So it's how you're paid, how you're treated when you're late, how you're treated if you stay late, how you're treated, if you produce more, how you're treated if you produce less. All of those things are in people's minds, right? Yeah. They're operating in an environment. And we're trying to change a process, but if we don't look at how all that works, then you don't get there.
The expression I use in the book is that when you see lean as a bunch of tools and techniques, it's like throwing them at the wall, but they've nothing to stick to.
Yeah.
And the culture is what they stick to. And the culture is what stops it being hard work. So
and makes it exciting and engaging and fun. And
you build a culture with that process of ownership and alignment at the top level, then I describe this process in the book. It's candor, commitment, coaching is about building a critical mass of coaches before you start that morning meeting process. And you really need that, especially in larger organizations, because too often a single individual tries to carry the whole thing and it fails. So you build that coach cadre of people. Then you move into the consistency chapter, which is the fourth out of the five. And that's about building your kata, your daily kata. And you can also have weekly and monthly things going on in there, but fundamentally about how you carry out that morning meeting and get your education and engagement, education, recognition, and your improvement time and 3Sing housekeeping process in there. I can't believe I used that word housekeeping. I never do that because it isn't that. And then finally, the last chapter is continuous learning, where that's the last place where people fall because they don't keep learning and it gets stagnant. So I learned this from Ryan at Seating Matters, is if you hit that dry spot in your improvement process, which everybody does, that's just a signal you need to deepen your training because Lexus are still doing it. And so you ain't Lexus, the chances are. So you have to deepen your understanding and help your people see their waste that's still there and drive on. And that last chapter is cool because we did an AME lean tour from here, from Lumen, in the business that I'm a partner in. And it was cool because it was another place that lean falls down. I think the traditional 7 or 8 wastes are fine for manufacturing, but they really don't work outside the shop floor. That's my genuine, that's my own experience, actually. So we came up with this different approach, and it's fundamentally lean. When it was first suggested, I thought it was lean heresy. When my business partner said, we've got other ways that aren't Ono's. And I was the conservative one going, no, we can't do that. But he totally convinced us that when you identify your own wastes, and it's particularly pertinent for third millennium companies that aren't in manufacturing, so an e-commerce company, for example, mm-hmm. or pure service-based business, when you identify what your wastes are and you name them, then your people see them all the time. It's brilliant.
As opposed to saying, well, this, we can translate this into this.
Absolutely, 100%.
We have from the shop for lean.
Bella, is people try to call computer files inventory. That's my favorite example of that. It's like, so Taichi Ono had excess inventory as one of his business killers because all the cash is tied up in inventory. And we're trying to make an analogous link to a computer file that on a server that costs like $20 a month. That's nonsense. That's honestly, it's nice to get nicely organized directories and stuff, but it's not business critical for a lot of people. So you'll have something in your business, and the process we recommend for that is that you look at what keeps the business leaders awake at night, and where are you losing customers, and where are your bottlenecks to grow the business? And you'll find your wastes in those places that you need to have the business focused on.
And then it doesn't matter what you call them, as long as everybody knows what you're talking about.
They are.
Right,
like one
right.
we have here at Lumen, for example, because we're shifting as a business. We're doing more and more manufacturing and assembly, but a lot of our business is still pure engineering work that's done on a computer. And our biggest waste is you got somebody that's deep in coding work and they get a tap on the shoulder from, where's the soldering wire? And it's like, well, and completely out of work. So we call that interruptions.
Yeah.
So the shoulder tap. No, that's waste.
That's a waste. Absolutely. And yeah, that's endemic. That's endemic. Yeah.
So we go over all that in the book as well. And then the other one we do is about standards. And this is, I actually have done whole podcasts on this. So a lot of time but fundamentally, we were doing standards the old way, like I've done for decades with camera phones and Excel and PowerPoint and stuff. Very laborious and nobody uses them. They're great for the auditors. That's the mm-hmm. truth of that. So we were doing that ourselves here at Lumen. My business partner, again, the smart one, he's the quiet guy, but the smart one. He was like, I spent like a whole afternoon doing this 12-step SOP for a new product launch we were doing. I showed it to him and I thought, he's going to say it's great. And he basically told me it was the brown stuff.
Yeah.
How long did that take? And he was like, you've got a software company. And I do have one of my business interests in a software development house. Long story short, we had this thing. Our first prototype.
The Gemba Docs.
Gemba Docs. We had it about 3 weeks. And it's basically transforms that whole process, makes it so easy to create SOPs. Like literally, that thing that would have took me 2 days. You could do it in an hour in this. We have some big brand name manufacturers using it. We've all kinds of, we've over 20 countries with customers in them now. It's awesome. It's our 1 year anniversary at the end of this month, but we transform it. We make it so fast and easy. Anybody can do it. So again, continuous improvement facilitator out there. I've been that role. Oh, you need to get all the SOPs done and you're the bottleneck. And it's horrible because you need to do all the SOPs for your plant or whatever. And you're the one doing them. You're going to be doing that for months. Whereas right, with this, right. it lets you deploy really fast and we can democratize it. Lots of people can do it. And then you can roll out so quick. And the biggest benefit of all, they own them because The previous way, like back to my very first job when I was writing quality procedures for ISO, it was called BS5750 for you oldies out there. And I used to write them in the office, like thinking how I would like them done, and take them out to the shop, basically get told to go away.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
And I learned really quick. I go out, I'd get the guys to tell me how to do it, how they were actually doing it, and I'd really heavily engage with them. But I still had to go back to the desk and write them up, and all that iteration takes forever. And guess who owns the process at the end of it?
You do.
I do. That's a big problem. And that's, again, what drives a lot of words I hate in Lean: auditing, compliance.
Right. That drives the hatred, right? Yeah. Somebody's going to come and they're going to check, and did I follow the process exactly? You know,
100%.
And if you're improving the process, you're not going to follow it exactly.
100%. You're giving them a pair of handcuffs and getting annoyed at them that they don't want them. So the brilliant thing with Gemba Docs is people own their own. So instead of being a set of handcuffs, they're a useful tool. So our little company here, we have 180 SOPs now. And we the management, we don't ask, very rarely we would ask somebody to write one. They get written because the guys want to write them because they're useful. Mm-hmm. All right. For example, we're launching a new product right now. When we built the first prototype, we did a Gemba doc. And each time we've moved further closer to production, we developed and developed and developed the Gemba doc. Before that, it would have been, how did we do this last time? But so we're able to do all the iterations you can do in the Gemba, like literally no back and forward, real-time stuff. And people are doing it themselves. They own it. They want to do it. And that's the big difference. Full stop, by the way, in Lean. And the Gemba Docs thing helped me understand that. A lot of what goes on in Lean is that pushing it onto people thing.
Right.
So you're off giving them their handcuffs. Whereas when you help them understand this is a useful tool, they'll pull it off you and you don't have to be a policeman anymore. It's brilliant. So we've done that. And for example, we've got customers who've binned 10 times more expensive software than Gemba Docs, and they're getting 10 times better results. Not because we're, you know, superhuman. That simple fact of the... Well, one, it's very easy for everybody to use, but the second part, the best part, is the ownership. And then you can deploy it through QR codes and print them off, and you can view them in the app, or you can put them on your production sheets as QR codes or a URL link on your desktop. There's all kinds of ways to access them. That's another key thing. But the joy I get, and I'm pretty sure you can feel it, from dealing with Gemba Docs customers on a daily basis, is outrageous, because it's a great tool to have in your Lean arsenal. Like, Ono wasn't joking when he put standards at the foundation of the Temple of Lean. It's been a heck of a journey.
But that documentation has always been a challenge, right? And that, you know, where do you keep it? How do you use it? And then when quality gets involved, well, how do you update it? Because the updating process becomes so onerous.
And we got that, again, we did the whole document control thing in Gemba Docs. So it's all fully in there. So you don't have to worry about all of that. And we have an approval process and all that kind of stuff built into it. So basically, if you're operating off the URL, like the link on your desktop or on a PC, you put it in your ERP system, that link's always live. It's always the latest link. You don't have to worry about the whole distribution and, you know, pulling the bad copies out and all that stuff. Like, I was a quality guy in the early part of my career. I know how painful that is. And also how auditors love to catch you out on it. But when you go this way, that takes that headache away. And Bella, we're probably getting near the end of our time.
We're very close to
as you know. But, you know, this is another fundamental thing that just something I've learned. You see, if you are trying to give somebody more burden, you're always going to be a cop.
Yes.
No matter what that process is, if you can't help them really clearly understand why they should accept more burden and why it's really in their own interest to do so, you're always going to be a cop. So unless, when you're thinking of making those improvements or doing those things in your daily Lean life, think about, is this going to make life easier for these people? I'll tell you an even bigger one. Are people going to want this?
Right.
Yeah. Key performance indicators are a classic for that. Do the people want the key performance indicators, or are they just another method for us to coerce them?
Right, right. It's another thing for management to look at.
And the answer to that, because there are good key performance indicators that people want to have. How am I doing? Like, you know, at a bar that we're all trying to reach and everything. That's all cool. So it's not that they're a bad thing all the time, but most of the time they're not. that's the truth of the matter. They're there because people want to monitor and control. And there's far too much coercion in our workplace, full stop. And I do see lean as a huge step away from that, with the respect for people and the dignity that people can be given in lean, which is the respecting personal sovereignty. That's what I really think culture can go to, where we're candid with each other as adults, and we all have choices about where we go and what we do. We don't have to constantly do this carrot and stick thing. That's really, please God, I think the world consciousness is rising above that. And that's my personal mission. I'm not joking. I want to lift the culture of work to a place that people are just smiling and want to do it, and get away from this schoolboy culture.
That would be absolutely terrific. So, Tom, what is your one piece of advice for a young person starting out?
Get on the Gemba.
Get on the Gemba.
Mm-hmm. And it's related to that. People always think that they have to be interesting. You know, I want to be interesting. The key to life is be the most interested.
The most interested. I think that's amazing. Be the most interested.
Be the most interested people in the person in the room. Be the most interested person in the meeting. Be the most interested person on the workplace. And you will go a hell of a long way. Because most people are disinterested. Most people are not engaged. Most people aren't present. Most people aren't sensitive to what's going on around them. And believe me, I'm overt about it. I'm a deeply spiritual human being. And the world is a wonderful place if you look at it that way. And if you're really, really sensitive and interested in it, it's an amazing experience. But most people are not here. They're disinterested. They're unengaged. They're thinking about their social media or world events that are way outside their control. And what we're really supposed to be doing is contributing and giving to this present moment that we are actually in right now ourselves here. And that's part of leaping.
So when you say that you know, be interested, it's about being interested in now.
Now
it's about being interested being the Gemba that you are at the moment.
Yeah, and give your best to that, and think about, how can I add to this moment? How can I make it better, and not be about me, and what do I get, and how do I take? Do the opposite, and trust me, honestly, this is through personal experience, the world changes and everything gets better. That's how you do it. It's really simple. but it takes a lot of practice and hard work to be like that on a regular daily basis, especially when you're under stressful situations and everything else. But the best part of that is, it's even more important when you're in those stressful situations that you do this, and that you look at things of, what's the higher path I can take?
Thank you.
So my next book is going to be called Improvement Starts Within, by the way. Around the subject.
Well, we'll look forward to that, Tom.
Thank
you so much for traveling with me to the edges of lean.
It was a ball, Bella. I enjoyed it. And if anybody's listening to this and they want to have me on their podcast or do an interview or whatever, I just love spreading this word. I think it's the best thing. It's my calling to do this and to try to help lift us in this way. And so if anybody wants to help me do that, the really important that you go to improvementstartswithi.com. All my personal contact details are on there. The book's on there for free. You can listen to the book on the Lean Play app. It's an Audible clone. You can listen to it on Audible. You can buy it on Amazon. All the information is on improvementstartswithi.com. And then if you liked what you heard me talk about Gemba Docs, it's a 30-day free trial. Mm-hmm. It's cheap as chips as software. Anybody that really needs it, and even if you can't afford it, reach out to me and I'll make sure you get it, because this is way more than just making a fast buck. It's if like we have, that's how I approach this. We're giving it free to education institutions, give it free to charities, give it free to anybody who says they can't afford it. But like, if you're working for some multi-billion dollar company, we won't believe you. but if you get the gist, yeah, that's all on gambadocs.com or download the app.
All right. Thanks, Tom. It's been great to have you.
It's been an absolute ball, Bella. Hopefully you'll have me on again sometime.
I will.
Cheers. And thanks a million. It's been a ball.
This is Bella Engelbach, and I'd like to thank Tom Hughes for being my guest on The Edges of Lean. What did you learn from this conversation? What ideas did it spark? We would love to hear from you. Find Tom at GembaDocs.com or on LinkedIn. Find me on LinkedIn or at leanforhumans.com, or comment wherever you watch or listen. Subscribe and tell a friend about The Edges of Lean. Please join me in exploring more of The Edges of Lean. There's a lot to learn. And check out my friends in the Lean Communicators community at leancommunicators.com. You'll find more podcasts and videos with lots of great new content every week. The Edges of Lean is written and produced by Bella Engelbach with support from Podcast Inc. This is a Lean for Humans production.